Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
And welcome to show number 125. Our thanks to Harrah's for their continued support and to Homestead Financial Mortgage. Great mortgage rates. Call 800-GRANNY-8. They have renewed as a sponsor of this show through the third quarter of this year, and we appreciate their support and yours as well for listening. Hi, I'm Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table in the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, where the Bad Beat jackpot has still not been hit. It is up to $272,000. You got a bunch of people playing cash games here and a bunch of tournament players sitting behind me as well. My partner, Dennis Phillips, is still out in Las Vegas, running back and forth between meetings and occasionally sitting down in some tournaments at the World Series of Poker. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. And you?
I'm doing just great. Let me plug our guest for today is Mike Sexton, the Poker Hall of Famer, one of the truly nicest guys in the game. We sat down with him at the Rio in Las Vegas for an extended conversation again this year. And just a few days ago, watched as Mike sat down in the $1,500 seven-card stud high-low event and not only made the final table, but made it to heads-up action against a player named Chris Vioxx, who graduated from the University of Illinois. And Chris had a big chip lead that Mike could not overcome. But congratulations to Mike on that second-place finish. That after earlier this year, making the final table at the WPT event at Bay 101, which aired on Fox Sportsnet on Sunday night, with Tony Dunst having to do the play-by-play because Mike was sitting at the table. Even though Mike was short-stacked and ended up going out first, he said, you know what, let Tony stay there with Vince Van Patten. I'm going to take the rest of the night off. So congratulations to Mike on a great year.
He really did. I watched the play for a little while there when he came in second and just barely missed a bracelet. With three tables left, he was in the bottom half. With two tables left, he was one of the short stacks. And he still, you know, it's one of those things, you know, a chip in a chair. Mike just never gives up. If he's got a chip in front of him, he's dangerous. And for him to finish second in there with the stack that he had, he did a tremendous job.
One of the things you'll hear us discussing with Mike today is something he told us last year on the show, which was that the game had changed so much that he still has the ability to make final tables. It's just that when he gets there, he doesn't have as many chips as some of the young, aggressive players. That seems to have been what happened to him at Bay 101, and apparently that was it in the stud event as well, right?
Absolutely. It's just difficult. He'll talk about it today, and he had a very valid point. When somebody's three betting back to you, you know, it's difficult to call with that pocket eights, with that ace jack suited, with, you know, so many other hands. Even if you have a better hand, just putting the pressure on the other person is just such a part of the game now that it didn't used to be.
Also, while we're at it, congratulations to Mike and the whole gang at the WPT, including Matt Savers, the tournament director, and Kimberly Lansing and Tony Dunst and Vince Van Patten and the Royal Flush Girls. That combination has helped their TV ratings go up 35% this season. They are now the top-rated show on Fox Sportsnet.
That's unbelievable. It just goes to prove a point. People love poker, I'm telling
you.
You
know what I think helped them a lot was that they dedicate time at the beginning of the show to showing what happened in the first day or two or 3 days of an event. Because up until this season, if you tuned in, you saw the final six players, and because a couple of them were always the short stacks, you saw a lot of shoving early on. It was really a shove fest and not a tournament. Here you got a much better sense of how things had played out over the course of a couple of days. You saw some of the big names who had gotten knocked out along the way. And I think that they've done a much better job of telling the story of the poker tournament, which, as we've seen through the years, through the World Series of Poker coverage and others, you got to get the viewers interested in the story. They've got to have a storyline to follow. And that's what I think they've done better this year on the WPT.
And I agree with that totally. It's much harder to do that, especially when you have something like the main event. You start out with 7,000 people in the field. Where are the stories? You have no idea. you're literally hunting and trying to find and trying to get something filmed so that it can be shown later, but you just don't know where it's at. It's got to be the same way with the WPT. So they're doing a much better job of that. They are developing storylines. They are giving background on people. Yeah, I think it's a heck of a lot better show now than it was.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your storyline. Have you played any tournaments in the week since our last show?
Well, yeah, I played some, and I have not done very well. I did not make it out of the first level of the seniors event.
Wow. the seniors event, by the way, but before you talk about what happened to you, let me just say, this year's seniors event at the World Series of Poker, the largest one ever, up 20% over last year, 3,752 players. It is the largest single-day live poker tournament in history anywhere, you know, not counting online things, but live poker. There's never been a tournament with a one-day turnout bigger than this one. That's unbelievable.
Oh, it's just, I've got some stories to tell you about down there at the Rio and what's been going on. To finish up the 30 seconds on my poker playing for the last few days, in the first level, I ended up with pocket jacks, lost a few hundred dollars of my chips, and laid it down to pocket kings. Ended up with ace king, raised, got called, had a horrible flop out there, and with a raise and re-raise ahead of me, laid that one down also, but now I'm down below 2,000. You got to remember on this one, you only start with 3,000 in chips.
Yeah.
So a couple of stabs at pots, and then you're short stacked very, very quickly. Well, I looked down at pocket aces and decided this is going to be my hand. I'm going to double up on this one, be back above starting chips, and away we go. Should have known better.
The classic story of pocket aces will win you a small pot or lose you a big one, and it must have been you lost the big one.
It was. I'm not going to get into any bad beats or anything like that. It just, you know, I raised it to six times the big blind, but the big blind was only 25. You know, it was 25-25. I made it 150. I ended up with two callers. Flop comes 10-10 rag out there. We get it all in, and he turns over a 10-8 offsuit. And I kind of went, never mind.
Yeah.
So, well, the good thing of that was I was able to dash over to the Venetian and play in their 2K event. Very well run, very much of a deep stack, a lot more poker playing going on there. They started out with about 260 players. They were paying the top 27. 52 of us advanced the day two, and I was right in the middle of the pack. I was about 20th, 22nd, right in that range, just a hair above chip average. So I was feeling fairly good. I had 87,000 in chips starting out day two. Chipped up to about 114,000, and then I ran into my nemesis again.
How Uh-oh, dare not pocket
I think
aces.
I can play pocket aces? Yeah, how dare I think I can play pocket aces? I'm not going to bore everybody with a story because we've all got 100 of them. It basically, raised it under the gun. I repopped it 2.5 times, 3 times what he had. Flop comes a 6 high. I honestly, you know, I bet, make a continuation bet of about 27,000. I mean, a substantial one. I had to from what I'd raised at preflop. And he shoves, and I can't lay it down with a 6 high board. I honestly thought he had like jacks or queens or maybe even kings. And he turned over pocket sixes, and never mind.
And there you go. You know, I'd like to adjust our prop bet that's been on for
and
a half now. instead of you going out of tournaments with ace king calling off your chips pre-flop, I'd like to make it that you get knocked out of a tournament with pocket aces. Can we do that?
Well, I don't know. I don't last about a week till that one hits. Something like that.
Maybe if we change the prop bet, your luck will change, and you'll only go out of tournaments for calling off your stack with ace king.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe that'd be it.
Anyhow, you mentioned
it just. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say you mentioned that there were other stories around the seniors event. I'm curious about what you saw there because a field of 3,752 players. That's an enormous one-day turnout. And remember, this is only players 50. And older. You have no young guns in a tournament like this. So to get numbers like that at what is supposedly now a young man's game, that's stunning to me.
Oh, it's just amazing. People were signing up the night before. They were worried they were not going to have enough seats for them. It was just unbelievable. And I've never seen that much gray hair in my life before. Of course, I fit right in, no doubt about it. And this is something, too, that you'd be impressed with. The lineups to the restrooms were out the door before the tournament started. And I was one of them standing in line. It was a great atmosphere, though. People were amazed by the number of turnouts. When I sat down at the table, there were a couple of people that I played with before, a couple of people that listened to our podcast, and we're talking about that. It was an enjoyable experience. It was a very short experience, but a very enjoyable one. But it leads me to something else that's going on at the Rio now, which is just absolutely flabbergasting me. They added 14 more tables in that alleyway between the convention center and the actual casino. So they're at 408 tables, I believe, out there now. They did not have an empty table from noon on Friday till at least 10 o'clock that night.
Wow.
They had to delay the single table sit-and-goes till at least 7 o'clock. They had to push the 2 o'clock tournament back to 4 o'clock in order to get enough tables just from the knockouts from the seniors. And it's been that way every day since then. They had over 1,000 people in their 2 o'clock, $200 tournament yesterday. This is just, it's unbelievable. They are up 45% on their satellites and mega satellites over last year.
Wow.
And it makes common sense. People are coming in there, they're not backed, or they don't have the big payroll or bankroll. Maybe they have money still sitting online somewhere. Maybe they are worried about it because they can't go back online and make a living. So they're trying to satellite in. They're trying to play some of the smaller ones and work their ways up. And these mega satellites and super satellites are literally qualifying dozens of people into these other events. Every table at the Rio, over 400 tables, jammed packed with people on the rail waiting to take your seats.
I'm still stunned by that. I'm still stunned by what you said about yesterday's 2 o'clock deep stack, that they had over 1,000 or 1,100 people in there, and all I can think about is when you mentioned a moment ago that you went over and played in a deep stack event at the Venetian. Granted, it was the 2K buy-in and not a 340 or a 550, which they also are running during this deep stack extravaganza. But I would have to bet that these deep stacks that Jack Effel has put in at the Rio are hurting business across town.
Well, but they're not that much. They're still getting a tremendous turnout. They're still getting a ton of people. The Venetian is getting 700 and 800 people in there for their $300 and $500 ones. They had just under 300 for their 2K. I have not been down to like Binion's. I've not been over to Caesars, and some of them are running smaller tournaments. But from what I'm hearing, they're having a very good turnout also. There are just thousands and thousands of poker players in Vegas right now, all looking for a table.
That's great.
Just amazing.
All right, let's talk about some of the go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to do the events themselves. Though the first 30 events for the WSOP is up 11.7% over last year. So not only are the satellites up, not only is the cash game up, not only are there more tournaments being held, not only are more of the casinos in Vegas holding tournaments, but the actual main events themselves, the bracelet events, are also up over 10%. It's just amazing to walk in there.
Yep.
So I am totally curious. I cannot wait to see what the main event brings and just how many people are going to be playing in this. And how many people are going to qualify, and how these satellites, they're going to start having $1,000 mega satellites of an evening to qualify for the main event. I wonder how many people are going to get into that to try and work their way into the main event.
Well, I think you might see people playing smaller single tables to win chips to get into those bigger megas and then win their way up. Almost like steps used to be on PokerStars to win your way up into the bigger event. I think you probably will see more people doing that.
I absolutely agree with you. I 100%. It's just it's amazing. I don't know where all these people are coming from, but if you want to play poker, you need to be in Vegas right now.
Well, I will still stand by my prediction when you and I picked some numbers for the main event this year. I let you set the over-under, and you said 5,273. I snap-called on the under, and I stand by that, although I think Daniel Negreanu's prediction on this show of 3,284, that might be in danger. The difference, however, is we're talking about an event where very few people will pay full price to sit down and play. In the seniors event, you had probably a large portion of that field who were picking out 10 Ben Franklins out of their pocket and laying them down for that $1,000 buy-in. That's a lot different than buying into the main event. The main event numbers over the years had been propped up by all the people who qualified on PokerStars and Full Tilt Poker and some of the other sites. And with that having been erased on April 15th by Black Friday, I still think that the numbers for the main event will be down, even if the rest of the WSOP and all of the ancillary events have been way up.
Well, they probably will be down. I'm feeling fairly comfortable with my projection right now, and I am glad you took the under. But at the time, I wasn't. I would have taken the under myself. But I think it will be more than the 5,200 now. I think they'll break the 6,000 mark just from what everything's been going. But I came in here very, very worried that this was going to fall flat on its face, and we were going to have numbers like Daniel was talking about. That has definitely not been the case. And I got to give credit to these guys. They've been faced with a lot of difficult things to do here because of the massive turnout, and they've handled it very, very well. They're trying to keep – you have 100 people lined up trying to get into sit-and-goes, and they're trying to keep them calm and do it in an orderly fashion. They're bringing in every dealer. We've had some very inexperienced dealers down there. Yep. But the floor people are handling it well. They're over there instantly making decisions, trying to make it – and the players are understanding too. Dealers are working extra hours and overtime, and they're bringing in people that have never dealt with this kind of a situation before. The WSOP is handling it and handling it well. Security is safe. I've seen very few flare-ups. I got to give kudos to them. They're doing a good job considering the massive turnout.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. He's Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris here at the feature table of Harris St. Louis. Thank you for listening. By the way, thank you also for boosting the numbers on our podcast downloads, including last week's show with Matt Affleck, who gave some great advice for people who are going to play in the $1,000 or $1,500 buy-ins there or are going to be playing in some of the events here at Harrah's. He gave some great tournament advice, and we had a lot of people downloading that who wanted to know what the strategies are for tournament play in the year 2011. If you missed that, you can go to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, click on the Final Table Radio Show, and you can listen to last week's show or all of our 124 shows prior to today. That's thechipleader.com. All right, let's talk about some of the people involved at the WSOP. Last week, we had to spend a couple of minutes congratulating Phil Hellmuth, the poker brat, who almost won his 12th bracelet, losing to John Juwanda heads up in the deuce to seven low ball draw championship, the 10K buy-in. And over the weekend, he did it again, also missing out on his 12th bracelet, but again coming in second, this time in the $10,000 buy-in, seven-card stud high-low championship. He lost to a guy named Eric Rodewig, who was the chip leader going into day three and then was the chip leader at the end of day three. This tournament ended just about 12 hours ago. It wasn't played out over the weekend, but just over the course of the last couple of days. Phil Hellmuth, who had been known as only a no-limit hold'em specialist, here now showing us his chops in deuce to seven and now in seven-stud high-low, has become the leader in the WSOP Player of the Year race. Are you stunned by that?
A little bit, but when we did the fantasy draft for ESPN, Phil was my second choice. He was the 17th player in the overall pick taken. So there is a lot of respect. We know he's playing a lot of the events. We know he's quite capable of taking down a tournament at any given time. So I'm not maybe as surprised as a lot of people are. A lot of these games involve just common card sense. And whatever you say about Phil, he's an extremely intelligent guy, and he does pick up cards fairly well.
Yep.
So... Don't be bad-mouthing the guy that's carrying me to victory on the ESPN fantasy draft.
Well, we're going to get to that in just a second. By the way, Phil has not won his 12th bracelet. It's been 4 years now, but you do have to give him credit for making it this close twice thus far, and we're only really halfway through, a little more than halfway through. I think today is event number 37, and there are 58, so we're about 60% of the way through the tournaments at the WSOP, and lots of small buy-in, no-limit events still to come. By the way, the pretty good final table there. The third-place finisher was last year's main event runner-up, John Raisner. Behind him, Ted Forrest. Behind him, David Benyamin. And I think Ali Aslami was at the final table as well. Not guys you want to sit down and play with 10K on the line. Also, congratulations to Andy Frankenberger, who just a few years ago was just a Wall Street guy who was going to try poker and qualified and got himself into an event and now has a WPT title. He was the WPT Player of the Year and now has a WSOP bracelet to his name after winning event number 28. That was a $1,500 buy-in, no limit hold'em. And also, we've got to give some kudos to our friend Norman Shad, who with Lon McCarron will once again be calling the action this year on ESPN when the coverage starts late next month. Not only did Norman write a terrific piece in the Washington Post defending the game of poker and players like us, but he also came in 12th in the $1,500 buy-in stud high-low event, the deepest run he's had in quite a long time, and must have been entertaining to be around him.
Oh, it's always entertaining to be around him. You never know what's going to come out of his mouth.
Now, let's get back to your ESPN fantasy draft. Phil Hellmuth got you some points. Who else has scored for you this year?
Well, Elke was my fourth pick, and he's done very well. He won the one tournament. He's actually in competition, too, for Player of the Year out there. J.C. Tran got a few points for me. Mike Manasaw got a few points for me. Alan Cunningham needs to do a little better. He's picked up all of 12 points for me so far, but he's playing all the events, and I expect him to do something. My disappointment, believe it or not, is Daniel. Daniel's having a horrible series right now. He's playing in almost every event, and I think he's got one small cash. But again, Daniel's just too good a player to be shut out. He'll do all right. I am in second place. I am 23 points behind. So the listing is about a flip-flop from what it was last year. So Daniel has his own team, and he's second from the bottom. But last year he was kicking everybody's tail.
Well, you know, a lot of people who saw the list of players that you chose said you chose way too many old school guys.
Yep.
But the old school guys have come through, and you had some new school guys like Bertrand Elke Grospelier, and they're coming through with you. Now, you mentioned Alan Cunningham. I've heard from some people at the Rio that he is actually walking around with a full tilt patch on. And I wonder, as you've been walking around the Rio in the few times you've been over there playing a tournament, if you've seen a lot of people wearing full tilt patches, and have you seen any of the big name full tilt people?
There are a few full tilt patches around there. Not very many, to be honest. And the majority of the hierarchy, shall we say, are not wearing the patches. There are some European ones that are. You'll still see some shirts, hats, stuff that people are wearing that will say full tilt on them. But versus last year, the presence is less than 10% of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very few people wearing it. There's a lot more stars starting to show up. A lot of the pros there, or almost all the pros there, are wearing their poker stars. People are talking about it. And the other thing is, there's almost no other branding whatsoever from any other site. You kind of an occasional one here and there, but it's virtually no branding at all this year at the WSOP.
Very interesting. The reason I asked about stars is because today marks 67 days. I'm sorry, I asked about full tilt because today marks 67 days with no word about full tilt players getting their money back. And it's been at least 3 weeks since the Phil Ivey story broke, and we haven't heard anything more from Full Tilt Poker at all, which if you're a Full Tilt player still with your money locked up in the U.S. or you're a listener of ours overseas and you've got money on Full Tilt, you've got to still be concerned about whether you're actually going to be able to make withdrawals, right?
I agree with you, but again, I have friends over there. I know the people that are intimately involved in this. They are good guys. I know they are trying their best to get this taken care of, and if it's any way possible, they will get the money back to the players. I don't have any special inside knowledge. I know that that's what they want to do. I know that's what they're striving to do, and I just hope they can get it taken care of and get it done. Yeah.
Okay.
They even got a third blow, a minor one, granted. They had the problems with obviously returning the money and the April 15th, and then the split with Phil Ivey and the rest of them. I guess Chloe's lawsuit is now back on track. The judge has allowed hers to continue on her lawsuit to try and get 1% ownership.
Really? The Cloney Gowan lawsuit? I hadn't heard that was back on.
That just came up today, popped up, that a judge is now going to allow her to proceed with it.
Wow.
So they're just getting hit from all... Of course, I'm not for sure there's much to proceed with now. I don't know what the heck's going on.
But have you spotted Howard Lederer or Chris Ferguson or Phil Ivey? I know Ivey said he wouldn't be at the series at all, but is he even playing in cash games over at Aria in Ivey's room?
Well, I think he is. I have not physically seen any of the three of them. I don't think any of them have made it to the Rio. I doubt if they do for the rest of the series. Phil is supposedly playing cash games around town. I'm not for sure if Chris Ferguson is even around. I have no idea at all. And that's a shame. You got three of the quality players, three of the people that have helped in a lot of ways to push poker forward. I mean, Howard has done a ton of things for charities and helping people out. A ton of things in Washington and working with the PPA trying to make this all legitimate, level playing field, whatever, you know, fully regulated industry. And now then, you know, he can't even go to the World Series. So,
yeah,
it's just, there's a lot of things not right about this.
All right, a quick note from a Twitter follower. You can follow me as Paul Harris Show. You can follow Dennis as Dennis_Phillips on Twitter. And we got a question from a listener by the name of Alex G., who says, last year you guys were talking a lot about the hype for Annette Oberstad at the World Series of Poker. Is there any hype this year for Daniel Jungleman Cates and Victor Blom, who are both now old enough to make their WSOP debuts? Have you seen any?
No. Very, very little. I'm not even sure that Victor Blum is going to be over here. He, last I knew, was still in Europe. Hadn't even made the trip yet. So I'm assuming he'll play the main event, but I don't even know that.
Victor Blum, for those of you who don't know, is Isildur 1. I do know that Jungleman Daniel Cates is out there. He's playing in the high limit, like 500 and 1,000 no limit games that are going on at the Rio.
Yeah, there are some cash games there that are just unbelievable. If you just like watching poker, you can come out and watch some tremendous cash games, and of all sorts. Do you know they're spreading over 20 tables of PLO a day down there now?
I do know that.
Probably more PLO than ever been put in a room anywhere before.
Yeah.
They've got a Chinese poker game going that Mike Manasseh needs to push away from the table, from what I hear. not having a good week. And it's just, you name it, the game is being spread, and spread at a lot of high levels.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis. Before we take a break here, and then we'll get to our Mike Sexton interview in the next half hour, I do have to talk to you about a little bit of a controversy at the WSOP, and that has to do with the hard stop, the 10-level rule. This is something that they put in, I think it was last year, possibly the year before, where the didn't matter when you started your tournament, whether it was at noon or at 5 o'clock or a restart at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon of a previous day's event, the maximum number of levels you would play would be 10. And at the end of 10 levels, no matter how many people were left in the tournament, you were going to stop and you were going to come back for the following day. Now, there have been several instances where that meant that they played past getting to a final table. You weren't just at your final nine, but they would continue to play down to 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. In Mike Sexton's case, when he was heads up with Chris Vioxx, they stopped it when it was heads up rather than letting them play out for another level or two or three or however long it was going to take. I'm curious what your take is on the hard stop at 10 levels.
Oh, I think it's totally wrong, and I think that'll be changed next year. That is the rule. Stop at 10. Okay. But there should be exceptions. You should be able to have a tournament director have the ability to talk to the players, to find out what they want to do, and to make some adjustments. There's no way in the world, if those two guys wanted to continue playing it out, they should have been allowed to do it. Now, maybe there's something with the ESPN webcast that causes the problem, and maybe there's something I'm unaware of. But I know if the players all agree that they want to either stop or continue, you should listen to them. And some way or other, the tournament director needs to be able to go over there and to talk to them and find out what's best for the players and what's best for the continuity of the game. I would hate to be heads up and have to stop like that.
Now, Jack Effel says that if they extended play to the next day in some of these and just stopped when they got down to a final table rather than playing it down to the end of whatever the level they were up to, there'd be 16 to 17 events that would be affected. That would have a rolling impact on staff for the next day for, you know, sometimes when they're going to have something like a seniors tournament and things would end up even being more upside down. But tell me what you say about strategy here. I mean, if you have played down to past the final table point, you know, you pass that bubble where now you're down to the final nine players, and you work down to 8 and 7 and 6 and 5 and 4, and then they say, okay, that's the end of the level, we're going to stop, and you'll come back in 12 hours at 3 o'clock this afternoon. What does that do to your strategy if you're one of those four?
Well, you don't know for sure. That's the problem. You walk away from the table, all four of you are going to be rethinking, well, and you start reanalyzing how you were playing, reanalyzing how the other guys were. You try to then figure out, do I need to change it? Do I need to be more aggressive? Do I need to sit back? How do I play against this particular person? You start pulling stuff up on the internet. You start watching how they played when they got down on final tables before. If I'm playing against the Mike Sexton, I'm going to review all of the hands and how he played and what his hand selection was like as he got shorter stacked. There isn't an answer to that, but it can definitely change the whole momentum of the game, the whole setup for it. I'm sure.
What about the stamina argument, Dennis? You have some guys who, you know, have played from 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and now it's midnight or maybe 1 o'clock, or if it was a 5 o'clock start, as with some of these bigger events are, the $10,000 events that start at 5 o'clock, like the 7-card stud, they're playing till 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. Is it fair to say to them, you have to keep playing even if we have to go till 7 or 8 a.m.?
No, you have a hard rule that it ends at 10, unless you can reach an agreement among the players. And then the tournament director should come over there, and he should have the four people there, and he should say, here's your options. We can continue to play to finish the table. We can quit it, come back at 4 o'clock tomorrow. You know, what do you guys want to do? And let them have a voice in it to see whether they want to continue or not. And all it would take is one person saying, sorry, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm whatever. I want to go get some sleep. And that's it, end of discussion. Right now, the way they have it set up, it's a hard and fast rule. When it dings at the end of 10 levels, you know, the dealer stops dealing, period, no matter what the situation is. They literally could do it right now with somebody with 99% of the chips on a heads-up match and force that person to come back the next day to play one hand.
I'll tell you the other thing that would be frustrating to me, not that I'm ever going to make it to a final table of one of these huge events at the World Series of Poker, mainly because I don't enter them. That's really a deterrent to my ever winning a bracelet. but if I were, I would think to myself, making the final table at the WSOP is a huge deal. You know, it may not be as big a deal for some of these big-name pros who have been there time and time again, but if you enter one of the Weekend Warrior $1,000 buy-ins or a $1,500 buy-in, and you work your way through a field of 2, 3, 4, 5,000 players, and you get down to the final nine, you want to say, let's come back tomorrow. That will give me a chance to call my friends. Maybe I could call my wife and she could fly out to watch me, even if I'm a short stack and I'm not likely to last long. That's a really big deal, making the final table of a big event at the WSOP, and I think you're robbed of that opportunity here.
I agree with you, and there's other scenarios too. say they're paying the top 300 in an event, and you have 317 people left when this level breaks. Now then, you're going to have 17 people that come back the next day, probably all of them extremely short-stacked, play for half an hour or 5 minutes or whatever, and not make any money. And that may prohibit them from playing in another event the next day. It could do all sorts of things. If the players are that close where it would take one more level to get down to the money or something, you ought to give them that option. There should be some discretionary
authority.
The tournament director, authority, there you go, that they should be able to do something that makes logical sense. Can you
imagine
301 people and they pay 300 and one guy has less than two big blinds and he has to come back the next day?
That would be terrible. Yeah.
That would be terrible.
All right, we've got to take a break here. When we come back, you'll hear our interview with Mike Sexton, the voice of the WPT, who just finished second in a $1,500 buy-in seven-card stud high-low event at this year's World Series of Poker. With Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I'm Paul Harris at Harrah's St. Louis. Our show brought to you in part by Homestead Financial Mortgage on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast via iTunes and on thechipleader.com.
Today we're happy to welcome Mike Sexton back to the show. You know, Mike, he's the main man at the World Poker Tour broadcast. He's been a longtime spokesperson for the Party Poker. WSOP record includes a bracelet for limit 7 stud, high or low, and 47 other caches, including last year you finished 10th in that 10K Omaha 8 championship. 2 years ago, you were inducted into the Poker Hall of Fame. You're one of the best promoters of poker around the world for the last two decades. Mike, welcome back to the final table.
I appreciate it, guys. Always good to be with you.
Great to have you back.
Is that one of the most noted voices in poker?
Well, absolutely.
You know, I'm telling you, I hear two words out of your mouth and know who it is. I don't care whether I'm, you know, can barely hear it on a TV or something like that. You just are associated with poker anymore.
It's so true. And the voice must be recognizable because when I go to airports, if I'm just talking to somebody at a bar, the guy next to me will stick his head. I knew that was you. I can recognize that voice. So, yeah, maybe that's a plus.
Well, Mike, this year was a kind of special one for you at the WPT because you not only announced the tournaments, but you also made the final table for the first time of a WPT Open event at Bay 101. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, it was sort of fun. You know, I actually played, I think, four or five events this season, cashed three times, and made the final table at the Bay 101. And it was fun. It was as much fun for the crew and everybody involved with the World Poker Tour staff as it was for me, honestly. The truth is I got there in a very short stack. You know, I was fortunate to even get to the final table probably. And, you know, I know from track records how tough it is to win from sixth place. It's only happened twice in the history of the World Poker Tour out of nine seasons. So it shows you mathematically it's just not going to happen very often when you start out in sixth place. And I was a distant sixth. So expectations by me at this final table, you know, I didn't have much, and I didn't feel the pressure. You know, I think you feel pressure much more when you go in as a chip leader. And you would know about that, you know. it does take a toll on you much more so, I think, when you're expected to win or you're at the top of the leaderboard going to the final table. And when you're on the bottom, you know, any spot you move up or the higher you move up, it's just, you know, a tip of the cap to you. But, you know, nobody expects much. Unfortunately, I did go out sixth. Did take a bad beat from Mike Mattisau, but, you know, that's another issue. But in truth, it was a fun event. It was fun to get to the final table, and I enjoyed it.
Well, anytime you have a final table, you can't complain. And well done and very well. That kind of brings another question. We talked to Eric Seidel earlier and asked him about how his play maybe has changed. How does he play against the younger, aggressive people, you know, all the 20-somethings that are at every table you go to now? Did you change your style any? Are you doing something a little different now?
Actually, I have changed my style some when I play No Limit Hold'em. And, you know, I learn, I understand, I see why guys are making the final table, all these young guys. And we have about four of them at least at every final table. Last year, the final table of the World Series, 8 out of 9 players at the final table were in their 20s. It shows you how strong youth is and how good these guys are nowadays. And, you know, and you say to yourself, okay, why are they getting there? Well, you see why they're getting there, because they're bold, they're aggressive, they're taking the lead, they're 3-betting, they're 4-betting, and they're just relentless. Mm-hmm. And they're not worried about going broke in tournaments. They're worried about accumulating chips. And when they get to the final table, they've got chips, and they're tough to beat. And, you know, that aspect of the 3-bet is something that basically is pretty new, you know, in terms of the mass of poker players from 20 years ago.
Yep.
You know, nobody three bet back in those days. You know, somebody would raise, everybody would call, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but now it's such a common thing, and it's a very strong, effective play. You know, when you really look at really how powerful the three bet is.
Yep.
You know, most people raise and no limit hold'em as they should when they've got ace jack, ace ten, king queen suited, two sevens, two eights. You know, you raise it. Now the guy behind you three bets. Now what do you do when it comes back to you? Now, do you just call here? If you miss the flop, you check, he bets, you give up the pot? Or do you fight for the pot and do all your chips? And the truth is, it's very tough to play against the guys that three-bet and take the lead and continue to fire at the pot because, you know, they could have nothing, but they could have something, in which case you're toast.
Yep.
So it's tough to play against. It really is, and that's something that I think you have to add to your arsenal, and I'm starting to do that a little bit more. And you have to be prepared to defend against the three-betters all the time also.
Yeah.
You just can't give it up to them every time they three-bet.
Right.
Because if you do, they'll just run over you.
Well, you told us a couple of years ago that you could make it to final tables now, but when you got there, you'd be the severe short stack, which is exactly what happened at Bay 101. So are you now four-betting the young guys because you think more likely than not they're doing it with air?
You know, you think they're doing it with air, but still it's tough to pull the trigger in battle, as you know. You know, and the four-bet basically means you're going to commit all your chips. If he five-bets it, you're just not going to give this pot up now. I don't care what you have. So, you know, are you willing to risk everything by doing that, you know? And you have to take risk. You got to take some chances somewhere along the line to survive. And you've got to bluff your share of pots when you play No Limit Hold'em tournaments. You've got to earn pots without having cards. You just don't catch enough cards in a tournament to win a tournament. Rule number one about tournament poker is tight players don't win tournaments, period.
Right.
They don't win tournaments. You don't pick up enough aces and kings. And if you're waiting for aces and kings, and everybody knows it, when you come into a pot, they don't give you action. So even when you get them, you don't make money because nobody gives you action. So the truth of the matter is you do have to be a little more aggressive. You got to earn pots without having cards, and that's what the great players do, and that's what these young guys do.
We had Matt Aflack here talking, and one of the things he said, he wants to create a table image that he's loose and playing a high percentage of the flops, seeing a whole lot of flops there. And he says if you can do that early on, then you can tighten up and play off of that image. And it's such a great way to play it. And he went into the math of it and back and forth, and I was very, very impressed with his analytical analysis of how he was playing that.
What?
And
yeah, no question about it. Image, and you're, you know, it's not how you think you play, whether you think you're a tight player or a loose player. It's the perception that other players have of you is what you've got to think about.
Right.
Do they think you're a tight player? Well, if they think you're a tight player, you've got to play off of that. If, on the other hand, they think you're a loose, aggressive player, you got to understand that as well. So, you know, I think image is a key factor, and knowing what your image is to the other players at the table. Now, obviously, in tournament poker, as you're switching tables all the time, you may have set an image up at this table, but it doesn't carry over to the next table you go at. Those guys don't know how you're playing, you know, so now you got to start all over again, and you got to understand that and recognize it.
All right, let's talk about a guy's image, a guy by the name of Dwight Pilgrim.
There you go.
Who has been making a mark for the last couple of years. He's one of the hottest young players in poker at age 28. He not only is aggressive with his chips, but aggressive with his mouth. And there was a fairly famous WPT show this year where Dwight took down the title at the Borgata, and he was trash-talking the entire final table. As you're sitting there and you're watching that, what do you think of a player like that?
Well, I'll tell you, he's a very entertaining player. You know, he's also a super player. He's an excellent poker player. It's probably the highlight show we had this season on the World Poker Tour, to tell you the truth. And as you said, you know, the guy was talking, and, you know, I love the guy. He says he's the Gracie of poker. That's his style. Gracie style poker means I do whatever it takes to win. I take him to the floor. I do stand up. I submit him. I knock him down. Whatever it takes to win, that's what I do. I adapt. And, you know, I love it, you know, and the guy is very entertaining. And the truth of the matter is, Vince, my co-host on the World Poker Tour, he said if this guy would have won in the first couple seasons on the World Poker Tour, he'd be like the biggest name out there in the poker world right now.
Yeah.
Because he's that entertaining, he's that much fun to watch, and he does have game. So, you know, I like the guy. Now, you know, I like guys that trash talk at the table. You know, honestly, I enjoy it because it's fun for me. Nothing they say phases me because I'm an experienced guy that it doesn't bother me, but it does affect some players at the table.
Yeah.
You know, but when Phil Helmuth comes to your table, you know, it's fun for me because everybody trash talks him, you know, and when he makes a mistake or does something, and it's a fun time to play poker, and, you know, that's just Dwight's game, and, you know, more power to him. And, you know, I hope he has a lot more success.
Certainly makes great TV. And off the air, by the way, away from the poker table, could you find a quieter guy?
No, he is. He's absolutely a great guy. I've had dinner with him. I've met him at a number of these different tournaments around here. He's a great guy just to sit around and relax with. Very humble off the table. He turns the switch on when he sits down there, though. We actually interviewed him. And I asked him, I said, well, can you take advantage of guys? Maybe it's the first time they've ever been on TV, and they don't want to get caught with that 9-3, you know, bluffing. And he immediately popped in and says, I want to get caught. Yeah. Catch me with a 9-3, please. That helps me for the rest of the tournament.
And he's so right about it. You know, it sells his image. And the truth of the matter, aggressive players, you know, guys that are attacking, that people see are raising with these 9-3s and those kind of hands, they're the guys that get paid off in the big pots when they make a hand.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's an advantage of being an aggressive player. And people think that you're just at it all the time with no cards, because you do get paid off when you do make a hand. And, you know, he's right about that. Advertise that.
And every now and then when you play that 6-4 under the gun, you raise with it or whatever, and then it comes out there and you end up with a straight and you have to show it. The reaction on the other people's faces are priceless.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you turn over the 6-4 and they look and went, but didn't you – wait, but
yeah, particularly if they look at you and thought you were the nit. When they profiled you and you sat down, oh, this guy's going to be the nitty guy I can push around. Yeah. And then you don't play a hand for a while. Then you turn it over for the 6-4 for the hidden straight. Bingo.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I went to a Mike Carroll seminar years ago, and he was talking about ace to five, low ball draw, and setting up a table image. And he said he'd always like to raise it and get called and be snowing with, like, threes full of deuces or something like that. And then he would check on the end instead of bet, you know, and he'd show down the full house, and everybody would say, what a moron this guy is. He said, but I set up the image, you know, and
there
so now I get played with every single time I play a pot after that. So I never forgot that story.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris with Dennis Phillips. We're at the 2011 World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, talking with one of the great voices of poker, Mike Sexton. You have been one of the great voices of our game, and earlier this year you wrote an op-ed piece about who would be the best person for poker when it came to winning the main event, and you chose Kara Scott. We talked to Kara about this. She was incredibly flattered. You actually moved her to tears, she said, when she read that. That's how much it meant to her. And I know you work with her on the WPT. Can you explain to our audience some of the reasons that you had for why you want her to win?
Well, obviously, I believe if a good-looking, intelligent young woman won the main event of the World Series of Poker, considered by to be a man's game, so to speak, you know, across the country in poker land. You know, we've never had a woman win that event. Only one have made the final table in that event. We've never had a woman win a no-limit tournament here at the World Series of Poker in 40 years. Now, I find that pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah. Yep.
And I just believe the publicity that it would render, every talk show, movie deals, book deals, and I know Kara is the perfect one to do interviews. She knows the game. She's well-spoken. She's good-looking. She would do every talk show, every circuit. Be perfect for a book, a movie, and I just can't imagine a better ambassador for poker to carry the torch on to the future than somebody like a Kara Scott.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, no, I love it. She said basically that if you had to have anyone in the poker industry endorse you, how could you have a better person than Mike Sexton?
Yeah.
And she literally was almost choked up when she mentioned it. You touched her when you said that.
Well, I appreciate that, but I mean it. If it's not Kara, I hope it's another young, good-looking woman.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
that's well-spoken, and that will do the talk show circuits, because that's vital.
Yeah,
somebody's got to go on Oprah. Somebody's got to go on Tonight Show, you know, the morning talk shows, and they've got to be willing to give back and take that time. Dennis, you know the time it takes
and
the demands it takes after you do so well in the main event of the World Series of Poker. Everybody wants to talk to you and see you and speak to you. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, you know, that you're donating. You know, you're not spending time playing poker or making money somewhere else. You're contributing this time because of what you benefited and that you want to give back to the community. And you were a fantastic representative for poker, of course. But I think that's what poker needs to go to the next step, to really make it mainstream. I mean, really mainstream.
Yeah.
I'm talking about CNN. I'm talking about every major network would want to do an interview with a young woman world champion of poker, no doubt about
it. Absolutely. That's why it's a shame that Kara won't be playing this year in the main event, because she's got her TV responsibilities for ESPN, and she'll be doing the broadcasting and the live streaming instead of being able to play in
it. I forgot about that. All right. Well, anyway.
Well, let me ask you about another thing, and I'm curious about whether you think this is good for poker. the super high roller events. They went from 25K to 100K to 250K. Next year, in the 2012 World Series of Poker, they're going to have a $1 million buy-in tournament. Now, 11% of that will go to charity, Guy La Liberté's One Drop Charity, which is a wonderful organization that helps people who don't have access to water around the world. That's great. But is a $1 million buy-in tournament good for poker?
Well, it's good, and it's going to raise that kind of money for charity. You know, it's bad, I think, in that whoever wins that tournament will be the all-time money leader in tournament poker history. Yeah. And it could be a businessman, it could be an amateur player, but for years and years in the industry, it no longer applies because of the power of the main event of the World Series. Now, I think I'm talking about what no longer applies is, for years, the guy that was ahead of that money chart was literally considered like the best player in the poker world. You know, and unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. And it's more impressive to be a card player, player of the year, for example, you know, even though you might not have won the main event, but you performed so well in all the rest of the events. And when you have these big buy-in tournaments, I'm just not sure that the money won from those tournaments should be applied to all-time poker winnings, because I don't think it gives the average guy any kind of chance ever to get on that list. Right. I really don't. And, you know, and I'm a fan of these things. I think anything above a 25,000 buy-in should not be included. You should have a separate list for big buy-in all-time money winners, something like that maybe. But, you know, it is money, and it does count, and the guy did earn it, you know, and he did put up $100,000 to play in a tournament, you know, and $250 to play in a tournament. You got to give guys credit that got that kind of money, that are willing to risk it and gamble it and rely on their skills, that think that they can outduel really a phenomenal lineup of players.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it. Anybody that puts up $100,000 to play in a poker tournament is a good poker player, period. You're not going to find good players playing
or,
in that tournament.
Or a crazy businessman.
Unfortunately, there are a few of them on there that I would question how good a quality player they are.
True.
But there are definitely the exceptions, not the rules on
that's
that.
That's true. And because those guys are in the tournament, that's what attracts more players to come in and play.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the truth. I predict there's at least 30 players that play in that $1 million tournament next year.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm saying it right here, right now. At least 30. You're going to see maybe more than that play.
Wow.
Wouldn't shock me if they got 40.
Wow.
Would not shock me if they got 40 players to play in that tournament. First of all, Guy has a lot of influence with a lot of people that have a lot of money.
Yep.
You know, and I play in some games in Beverly Hills of people that got money, and they're already talking about, thinking about playing in that, in Guy's $1 million tournament. You know,
wow.
So it could happen. And now the more businessmen you get in, you know, the more people are going to find sponsors as great players with people that got money to stick them in the tournament as well. So that's why I think they might get that number. And obviously, you're going to raise a lot of money for a very worthwhile charity. So that's a good thing. But honestly, you almost just hate to see the guys that have deep pockets, you know, getting all the press and all the recognition and all this and that just because they've got big buy-in and they've got big money. And obviously, as we know, you know, many of the Full Tilt guys, for example, that were shareholders that made a lot of money are the guys that play in these $100,000 buy-in tournaments because you have outside revenue coming in where you can afford to do this kind of thing.
And, yeah.
You know, not many just standard poker players, unless you've cashed some big-time tournaments for at least $1 million, are going to pony up $100,000 to play a poker tournament.
Yeah, I don't know. This $1 million one, I have big questions. On one side, something needs to fill the void of some of the TV shows that have left. You have to have something interesting, something entertaining, something that people will want to watch. They're going to want to watch these kind of stakes. There's no doubt about it.
Sure.
On the other side of it, though, the guy that is the grinder, the guy that is really working his butt off, the one that is such a good player but hasn't maybe cashed big yet or whatever like that, he's not going to be in this tournament. He's not going to be in front of the TV. He's not going to get rewarded at all. I don't know. But I will tell you one thing. If you have 40 people in the tournament and half of them are businessmen that don't make the standard plays in that, you're going to see some crazy poker out there for that kind of money.
Absolutely.
I think that's going to be – actually, I'm going to watch it for that reason.
Everybody's going to watch it. Let me tell you that right now. Let's face it. People are curious to see who can put up this kind of money to play a tournament, number one. And to me, watching this tournament, it's going to be as much fun and exciting to see the guy that goes out on the bubble as the guy that wins the title.
Yeah.
We're talking about $1.5 million bubble.
Oh, my gosh. No kidding.
I mean, think about it.
I hadn't even thought of that. Absolutely.
And, you know, that will be drama in itself. You can make a whole show out of the bubble guy.
Yeah.
You know? And
you're right.
Can you imagine $1 million bubble? I mean, it's, you know, but I think that the publicity that it's going to stir up is going to be really something. It's not going to shock me if you end up seeing a Donald Trump and some of these guys play
well,
this tournament as well before it's over with, you know?
Possible. One last thing I want to talk about. I know you got to run off to a tournament here. We appreciate your time. But I wanted to ask you about some of these guys. You know, you hear a lot of the young guys, especially in the last few years, starting to diss guys who've been in the business a long time. Sometimes you get it. Sometimes Doyle gets it. Sometimes anybody who's been around since, you know, the 90s has been considered, an old school poker player. There's a guy from Sweden by the name of Chris Bjorn. I don't know if you know him or not.
I know him very well.
He came in second in the Deuce of Seven lowball event here at the series. He has cashed in 205 events in the last 20 years, which means he's cashing in 10 events a year for 20 years. He's got 59 cashes at the World Series. He's got two bracelets. When I look at a guy like that, I say, this is one of the guys who has been so long a great part of poker. He gets no respect when he gets to the table. They look at him and go, old guy, I'm going to take advantage of him. Can you ever change that perception, or does Chris like having that image at the table?
He probably likes it. First of all, he's probably the nicest guy in the poker world, number one.
Absolutely.
And number two, he's a guy that's not an egomaniac like most of the top poker players are. He's very quiet, subtle, goes about his business quietly, you know, and stays below the radar. And the truth is, a lot of young guys probably don't even know who he is.
Right.
They probably got no clue the guy's cashed 50-some times at the World Series of Poker. They don't know he's been around for 25 years, you know. And he's a phenomenal guy. I mean, I'm his biggest fan, I got to tell you the truth, just the way he handles himself. I'm talking about his disposition, his kindness, his generosity, his – the guy's a super guy, and I wish him all the success in the world. I wish he'd have won the bracelet.
We need more guys like that, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I think that young guys – I really don't think young guys really appreciate the history of poker as they should, number one. You know, where the old guys came from, how poker's evolved to this stage where these guys get a chance to make $1 million when they're 22 years old.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, they need to appreciate that. In the old days coming up, nobody could make that kind of money when you were young. Even the main event of the World Series didn't pay anywhere near that kind of money. So to make money in the poker world, you literally had to start out playing 10-20 poker, 15-30 poker, 20-40 poker, and move up to 30-60, 50-100, 75-150, and 200-400. And if you see all the great players over the years, that's how they started out.
Yep.
They'd play a year or two of 15-30, a year or two of 20-40, a year or two of 30-60. Finally, they're paying 75-150 after about 8 years. And in 10 years, they're playing 200-400. And that's how they did it. They built their bankroll by working hard and putting in 60 hours a week for 10 years in a row to get up to that top level. Now, a guy can come in, take off a big tournament. He's a millionaire.
Yep.
Yeah, you're absolutely right with that. But I'm telling you, you got on your sleeve right there, poker gives. And if I can make a couple comments, I would, and then let you talk about it. I believe that the inaugural thing you had for Poker Gives was for the Women's Hall of Fame a couple years ago. I was lucky enough to be there. I bought a table for a group and saw you kick it off. Great organization. I just got texted by a guy in New Bedford, Massachusetts, who's holding a poker tournament for a cousin of his who died overseas, was killed by a roadside bomb. And he asked me to send something up there, which I'm going to do. And he said the money's going to be sent to Poker Gives. So if you wouldn't mind, could you talk about Poker Gives for just a moment?
Yeah. Well, Dennis, you've been a big part of our success. We appreciate that. But Poker Gives was a charity organization that was set up by Linda Johnson, Jan Fisher, Lisa Tenner, and myself. On behalf of the poker industry, we wanted to contribute to mainstream charities. So what we're trying to do is have an organization that can be sort of a central focus point and hopes that the poker community responds and contributes to this so we can contribute money on behalf of the industry to these worthwhile charities, such as Paralyzed Veterans of America, such as the Special Olympics and the U.S. Fallen Heroes and those kind of things. And, we're working hard at it. We're trying. So many people like yourself are getting involved and helping a bit here. And, you know, if the industry united and got behind this, I believe we could raise millions of dollars each year for these worthwhile charities. And once you start doing that and the outside world recognizes that the poker world is contributing millions of dollars to these worthwhile causes, everybody's going to take a step back and say, whoa, you know, these poker people are pretty good people.
Yeah.
And what your listeners might not know is, according to Fundraiser.com, the number one way to raise money for charities today is poker tournaments. was golf tournaments for a long time. Now it's poker tournaments.
Really? Wow.
So that's pretty impressive stuff. So even if it's not for our charity, if it's for any other charity or anything else, you got to salute the poker world for at least stepping up and raising money for these charities. And everybody's having poker tournaments to raise money, as you know.
Yes,
that you get
time.
Invited to every one of them, so you ought to know.
I do get invited. Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't go to a lot of them, but I'm telling you, in St. Louis, every weekend, there's a poker tournament going somewhere, raising it, and they're always a worthwhile cause. You always try to help them out as best you can. But I did not know that it was the number one, but it doesn't surprise me.
No,
not a bit.
Absolutely. Mike, you've done so much for the industry. Thank you for all of that. Good luck this summer at the series. Good luck with Season 10 of the World Poker Tour and with all your other endeavors. We appreciate it so
much.
Next
time, can you win the damn tournament?
Well, we're going to try. We'll see what we can do.
Don't get their short stack. That's the problem.
All right. Paul, Dennis, I appreciate it, guys. Anytime I can come on, I'll be happy to be a guest.
That's Mike Sexton, the voice of the World Poker Tour. He's been hosting that through 9 seasons. They're actually in the midst of their 9th season now and having their most successful season ever with their ratings up 35%. We recorded that just before Mike went off to play in the $1,500 7-card stud high-low event at the World Series of Poker, in which he worked his way through the field and ended up finishing second after a heads-up battle of several hours against Chris Vioxx, the University of Illinois graduate. So our thanks to Mike for spending time with us. It's always great to sit down with him. And for those of you who are wondering, yes, his hands were moving the entire time we were talking to him. Mike Sexton, if you tied Mike's hands behind his back, I don't think he could actually talk. He just has to get his hands in motion. And it's really a pleasure sitting down and talking with him. We have more coming up over the course of the next couple of weeks, more of our interviews that we've recorded at the World Series of Poker and continuing coverage of that event as well. Dennis mentioned early on that Las Vegas is the place to be if you want to play poker, but if you can't be there, then Harrah's St. Louis is the place to play. There are cash games going on here every day, from small limit games like $3 and $6 to 1-2 and 1-2-5 no limit games to PLO games that go 4 or 5 nights a week, with a $500 max buy-in, and the action can get crazy in those. And if you are a tournament player, there are 13 tournaments every week here at Harrah's St. Louis. You can get the full schedule at harrahs.com/STLPoker. I will tell you that if you are a person who works all day long in a 9-to-5 job, you can come over here and put $60 down in one of the 7 o'clock tournaments 5 nights a week and take a shot at that. There are actually 10 $60 events between the 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock events in the course of the week. 10 of those every week. Thursday nights, they've got the $160 buy-in. Friday nights, the $125 buy-in. And Saturday afternoons, another $125. And on the first Saturday of every month, which this year will be on July 4th weekend, on July 2nd, they've got the $310 buy-in event, which is deep stack and long levels and really a pleasure to play in. So come on out here and play some poker at Harrah's St. Louis. And don't forget about the rest of the table games and the restaurants and the piano bar and so much more. For more information, go to harrahsstlewis.com, or for the Poker Room tournament schedule, is harrahs.com/STLPoker. With Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I'm Paul Harris at the feature table in the Harrah's Poker Room. We'll see you again next Tuesday at 3 for our live show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And if you miss it or any of our podcasts over these 125 weeks, you can get them via iTunes or on thechipleader.com.